is the Tom Hartman Program.
And happy Monday. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Can you be a Republican and a Christian? Interesting question. Is Ted Cruz delusional? Another, as opposed to simply a liar. Another interesting question. In our second hour, by the way, we are Ian Millhiser is going to drop by. We're going to be talking about the Supreme Court. And in our third hour, we're going to get into this new government report suggesting that veganism, like no plant and no animal products, is actually the best thing for all of us and for our planet. It's got the right going nuts, and of course the meat board. But I want to start with Ted Cruz. Sophia McLennan wrote a piece over at Alternet, which is in part based on a brilliant piece of research that was published back about 5 years ago by Brendan Nyhan and Jason Reifler, titled When Corrections Fail, The Persistence of Political Misperceptions. They quote. They start out by quoting Mark Twain. He said, it ain't what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you know for sure that ain't so. Right? Which is essentially the joke that Reagan told about liberals, if you'll recall. But there's apparently an astonishing amount of truth to this idea that if people are misinformed, that is worse than if they are uninformed. Because somebody who's misinformed, somebody who believes something that's not true, not only is harder to convince of what is true, but when confronted with evidence of what's true, they actually, more often than not, will dig in their heels and say to themselves, this is called, you know, confirmation bias, they will say to themselves, well, you know, must be something wrong with that research. Well, that can't be right, or whatever. And so it's like, you know, this is, well, here's the study. They said, we conducted four experiments in which subjects read mock news articles that included either a misleading claim from a politician or a misleading claim and a correction. Results indicate that corrections frequently fail to reduce misperceptions. And then they say, we also document the several instances of the backfire effect in which corrections actually increase misperceptions. So, for example, the Daily Beast reports, this is Sophia McLennan writing over at Alternet, it's up at the very top of the page right now. The Daily Beast reports that Cruz's PolitiFact track record for publicly asserted falsehoods is the second highest among front runners, totaling 56% of all statements they've looked at. Googling Ted Cruz lies pulls back an astonishing 7.8 million results. And on Twitter, Ted Cruz and lies, the two phrases are basically synonymous. But here's the thing, and this is the point that Sophia makes, is that lying actually requires you to know that what you're saying is not true. So when Ted Cruz makes delusional comments about climate change, or when he lies about the number of IRS agents out there and what they're up to, when he lies about how his assertion that as gun ownership goes up, crime goes down, no, it's actually the other way around, but you know he doesn't get it, right? He does. He knows something that isn't true. And he keeps repeating it, a whole bunch of these things, over and over and over again. The big one, obviously, is that America is a Christian nation. I mean, Ted Cruz rolled out this ad over the weekend saying, you know, I'm here for God and Jesus. Vote for me. Of course, you know, yesterday was Easter Sunday, and they played it on Fox News on their Killing Jesus show that Bill O'Reilly wrote Bill O'Reilly's ghostwriter wrote the book for, but I don't know, maybe Bill O'Reilly wrote it. They also found that any challenge to their beliefs is likely to backfire. This again from the Alternet piece, Nyan and Reifler found that when conservatives who thought there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq were exposed to news stories correcting that view, the correction backfired. That is, conservatives who received a correction telling them that Iraq didn't have WMDs were actually more likely to believe that Iraq did have WMDs than people in the control group who didn't have a belief to begin with and simply looked at the facts. This means that exposure to the truth not only failed to adjust their views to reality, it made them more likely to believe in their false ideas and even more strongly. And Sophia says this is why Cruz's candidacy is really scary. For example, you know, just some statistics from real life that Sophia points out in her article. She says, you know, back in 2008, we learned that during the Bush administration, they made up 935 false statements in the lead up to the Iraq war. 935 confirmed lies pushed out to the press, pushed out to the American people, pushed out to Congress, pushed out to the world by the George W. Bush, Dick Cheney administration. 935 lies to justify invading a country that not only had no intention of attacking us, had no means to attack us, but was sitting on top of 10% of the world's oil supply, as Dick Cheney loved to point out. So you would think now here, 6 years later, that pretty much everybody would know that the Bush administration lied us into Iraq and that there was no WMD. Or maybe they made a horrible mistake and there was no WMD, because there was no WMD there. 40% of Americans still think that we found WMDs in Iraq. 40%. Now, where are they getting these ideas from? Where is this stuff coming from? I have said many times that in the Republican Party, you have basically three categories of people. You've got the rich people. You've got the paid shills for the rich people whose job it is to convince the suckers that they should vote Republican. And you got the suckers who vote Republican. Now, what happens when the rich people are delusional, believe a fantasy, right? They believe that Ayn Rand's novel was actually right. That you know, this brother and sister who inherited a railroad from their father are noble capitalists. Forget the fact that they inherited it. And the fact that they're rich makes them morally right. And the unions and the bureaucrats and the workers, they're all just sniveling slobs. They're the rabble. And so you get somebody like Ted Cruz who believes this stuff, and it gets very, very bizarre. Here's another example. Sam Brownback. Sam Brownback in Kansas. He believed, I believe that he believed this. I don't think that you would make an experiment with your state this big without actually believing that you knew how it was going to play out. He did away with taxes on pass-through companies, which includes a lot of apparently what the Koch brothers make who live in Kansas. But so now if you get your taxes from Alan Pike's article on Think Progress, if you get your taxes, if you get your income, for example, collecting royalties from books, interesting, or other non-wage compensation, you don't pay any income, no income tax in Kansas. So what's happened? Well, the government is in a crisis. So what are they doing? They're cutting the academic year. They're cutting back. Some of these schools are sending students home early so that Sam Brownback could give a tax cut to his billionaire buddies. Now, is he going to say, oops? No, he's going to figure out a way to justify this because it's coming out of a belief.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It raises a whole bunch of really interesting questions. Where are these beliefs coming from? Who's pushing this stuff? How do we push back on it? And is it even fundamentally American? And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And Rusty in Neosho, Missouri. Hey, Rusty, what's up?
How are you doing today, Tom?
Just fine, thank you. What's on your mind?
Well, I was calling to tell you about how my family is here in Neosho. My uncle believes that the only news there is Fox News.
Right.
And pretty much Ted Cruz is their leading candidate that they would love to be president. And I was just calling to actually tell you, if a dog was running on the Republican card, they'd vote for the dog instead of a Democrat.
Yeah.
And that's how far, far, far out they are.
So in your experience or opinion, Rusty, these delusions are coming from Fox News?
Oh, many of them are. They also, I'm sure they listen to the Rush Limbaugh and the Glenn Becks also.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things we know about people who watch Fox News is that they are not only more likely to be uninformed about most of the events happening in the world, but they're more likely to be misinformed.
They're misinformed, that's for sure.
Yeah, and that's the problem, when they believe something that ain't so.
And like yesterday during Easter dinner, you know, I'm sitting there, and thank goodness politics didn't come up this time, but usually whenever it does, I'm looked at, well, you don't know what you're talking about. You're crazy and everything. I'm saying, well, the thing is, I would love for y'all to look up on Media Matters and see what it says.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen.
Well, they're not going to want to go to Media Matters. They're not going to want to look that up. And if they do, it may actually cause them to bind themselves even more closely to Fox News. I mean, as long as the big lies are being promulgated and being pushed over and over and over again, people don't, you know, people want some certainty. They want some safety. They want some sense of some reassurance, some sense of oh, that's how the world works. And that's
right.
That's the story behind a lot of the news, in quotes, stuff that's on Fox. It's not the story that's behind the news stuff on CNN, by and large, at all. And it's only occasionally, you know, the kind of backstory worldview stuff is only occasionally presented on MSNBC. But it is all day, every day, 24/7 on Fox. And, you know, and the other problem, Rusty, when you say they think that Fox is the only news that's out there, there are a lot of times of the day and days of the week when that's true. I mean, one of the most frustrating things about my weekends, because I'm home and that's the only time I can turn on the TV on, basically. You know, my radio and TV work day here, I'm you know, in the studio at 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and I get home at 9 o'clock at night after doing the TV show. And all through that time, I really don't have any ability to watch TV. On the weekends, I turn on the TV and I'm trying to watch. I want the news, you know. I want to catch up on what's going on in the world. And MSNBC is running documentaries on caught on camera or what it's like to be in prison.
Locked up, yeah.
Right. And CNN is running documentaries on you know, some guy who loves food tromping around to Malaysia or something. And you go to Fox, and they're actually talking about the news. Now, they're talking about it in ways that make me crazy, but they're actually talking about the news.
Yep, that's true.
and the other thing is that, you know, Fox and CNN are the only two channels that are basic cable. MSNBC, you got to pay an extra $5 a month or whatever it is in your local area for. And so a lot of people don't even have access to MSNBC, and CNN is becoming less and less news as time goes on. So Fox is becoming kind of the default news station for our country, which is really damn scary stuff. Rusty, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. Okay, so back to this whole concept of how conservatives, and by the way, is even the reasonable question, I mean, is it possible that at the core of all this thing is some kind of fundamental psychopathology that's held by somebody over at Fox News, presumably Roger Ailes, but who knows? Rupert Murdoch, Bill Salmon, I don't know. But the people who are basically programming that channel, constantly looking for stories that make black people look bad, that make Christians look persecuted, that make gay people look bad. Yeah, you get it. You know, everything that they're and now, you know, highlighting all these critics of Obama's Iran deal without really getting into a good, honest conversation about the details of it. Which leads us to the presidential candidates. Rand Paul has flipped enough times on enough issues that I think it's probably safe to say that he's not so much delusional as he is hopeful. Right? Rand Paul will say whatever it takes to get him elected. He's figured out that, you know, there's kind of a Republican fringe out there, particularly among young people, not even Republican, libertarian fringe out there, that will follow him the way they followed his dad. And he's trying to expand that marketplace to a larger part of the Republican Party, except that, you know, increasingly the Republican Party is being taken over by the Tea Party, and the Tea Party, of course, funded by Americans for Prosperity and the Koch brothers, and they, of course, being libertarians. So this libertarian worldview keeps creeping in, which suggests that, I mean, the essence of the libertarian worldview is that the only reason to have government is for the defense of the country and to stop bad guys, basically army and police. And that everything else should be provided by some rich guy or some big corporation. Everything else in the world, everything else in our lives, everything else even the government does should be done for a buck rather than for the public square, for the public good. And this relatively subtle and yet at the same time fairly clear difference between what should be private, what's the appropriate revenue venue of private industry, and what should be public, what are the things that we really don't want somebody doing on a let's make a buck basis? And therefore, it should be done by government. In the separation of these two, there's a fairly large amount of common sense involved with it, but not among libertarians. And so we see, you know, time after time after time, these so-called libertarian experiments, you know, states that want to, well, they tried to do this in Tennessee, and the Koch brothers wouldn't even let them do that. You know, Americans for Prosperity came in with a big advertising campaign and shut down the thing, but they were going to expand TennCare, Tennessee's Medicaid program. And they figured out a way, the Republican governor, the Republican legislature figured out a way to do this that was, quote, libertarian. In other words, they were taking the federal money, but they were running it through for-profit corporations who would skim 10, 20, 30% off the top and kick some of that back to the Republican politicians in the form of campaign contributions. And even that wasn't good enough for Americans for Prosperity / the Koch brothers. So here we have this situation where, you know, the title of Sophia McLennan's article, Ted Cruz isn't an idiot, he's delusional, and that's far more dangerous. That's dangerous. But the bigger question, the people who are funding not just the Republican Party, but this ground operation across the United States, Americans for Prosperity, that may even be at least as good as or an effective as, perhaps better than the Republican Party at turning out the vote and all that kind of thing. That these folks, that would be the Koch brothers, may be delusional themselves. They may live in a bubble where they believe their own personal belief and philosophy, and they look at what Sam Brownback did and say, well, you know, it's a fluke. Just keep doing it. And nobody has, you know, apparently nobody's ever sat down with Charles and David and said, you know, there has never been a successful libertarian country in the history of the world. Unless your definition of success is that it's a country that only works for rich people. Now, they're the second richest family in America, so it may well be that the second half of that statement is just fine with them. So what are they, you know, but then you've got, you know, as I said, you've got rich people, you've got the shills for the rich people, and you've got the suckers. How do you deal with the suckers? I mean, Sam Brownback cutting the Koch brothers' taxes massively, cutting billions out of his state's budget and throwing the state 2 credit downgrades. They're having to kick kids out of school. Because they can't afford to educate their children. I'm not talking about even higher education, which has been cut as well. So what do you do? Well, in Kansas, they just passed a bill on Friday that says the Kansas welfare recipients cannot get more than $25 a day in benefits. So if you want to pay your rent and your rent's $200, every day for 8 days, you have to go to the ATM and get your $25 out. And by the way, every time you do that, you get charged 85 cents because they run all this stuff through, you know, one of the big banks. You get these bank cards. But on top of that, you can't use your money for a cruise ship. Yeah, Let's talk about that. That's really going to distract people.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
From the horror freak show disastrous experiment that Sam Brownback did in the in Kokistan in Kansas. Twenty-eight minutes before the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And I just a couple of quick things, and then I'll pick up your phone calls here. FantasticFungi.com. FantasticFungi.com. Louis Schwartzberg's website. They're still doing this Kickstarter campaign to put together this movie about how mushrooms can save the world. I don't know how to say it. Go over and check it out. You'll be amazed. It's just amazing stuff. Okay, silly poor people, money is for rich people, right? Right. This is that's the headline. You know, no cruise ship for you, Kansas poor. As if somebody's going to use their benefits, their welfare benefits for a cruise ship. I mean, really? It's Kansas, yeah. I mean, do they even have cruise ships in Kansas? No, they don't. Well, I guess that's a safe thing to ban then. It's sort of like, you know, us saying, well, you know, let's ban the use of federal funds from, I don't know, flying saucers, although we may have some of those. Who knows? But so there's that. And then the larger delusion that is being peddled aggressively now by Fox so-called News and by a so-called religious right is that America, it was founded as a Christian country, and that there's a long list of people that Jesus hates that we're supposed to hate, too. Right. The Jesus hates people who are Muslim. The Jesus hates people who are gay. That Jesus hates people who are poor. This quote, gospel of prosperity. And, you know, Ted Cruz is all wired into that whole network of these prosperity preachers where they're out there going, yeah, just do what God tells you to do and you will get rich. And there's, you know, subtle variations of that in the Mormon church. You know, tithe 10% of everything you get. You'll get back that tenfold. You'll get richer and richer. Just look at Mitt Romney. And these are belief systems that are informed by, in many cases, lies. I mean, you know, David Barton makes stuff up and then goes on Glenn Beck and Fox so-called News and whatnot and says, oh, the founders said this. No, they didn't. As just, you know, one of many examples. David, in Loves Park, Illinois. Hey, David, you're running for city council now?
I am, sir.
And the election's tomorrow?
The election is tomorrow, yes.
So give us the 20-second elevator pitch here.
Well, you know, I mean, I've done everything a candidate is supposed to do: knock on doors, do the, you know, with the flyers, the robocall, well, to specific people, going, you know, having town halls, shaking hands, and just trying to get my name out there. And I mean, I don't know what else to do. And I think at this point, it's just in the hands of the people of Loves Park to see if they want to go in a different direction.
And what's your name, David?
It's David Saul, S-O-L, and the website is ElectDavidSaul.com.
Okay, ElectDavidSaul.com. David S O L.
And if I may, real quick, I also wanted to say that anyone who's listening to this program right now who lives in Winnebago County here in Illinois, or DeKalb County, actually, in both counties here in Illinois, there's going to be a ballot question at the end of their ballot. It's from Represent Us, and it has to do – I'm not going to read the questions. I don't have it in front of me, but it has to do with the idea if we, the people, believe that an amendment should be passed that removes the corrupting influence of money of the political system.
Hoo-hoo.
Binding question. Yeah. And so we're hoping to get that, you know, going and hope, well, that group, I should say. I'm a member of that group, but I let them do most of the work. You know, I don't mind giving a quick plug for that because that ballot initiative definitely needs as many yes votes as possible to send a clear message to our leaders in Springfield and ultimately D.C. And I know that Sanders has certainly talked about it, you know, on your show. And so, yeah, and, you know, different way of doing it. You've got, like, what is it, the Wolf Pack, and this is Representative Us, Move On, not Move On, excuse me.
Move to Amend.
Move to Amend.
Yeah, yeah, there's a bunch of.
And so,
David, I that's more than a 20-second plug. I need to move along, but thank you. David, once again, your last name is?
S-O-L-L.
S-O-L-L, two L's. Okay. So it's electdavidsoul, S-O-L-L.com, and people can find you on the ballot tomorrow. Good luck, David.
Yes,
good
thank luck. You, sir.
Thanks
all
a
right,
lot for
bye-bye.
The call. Jeff in Langston, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's Lancaster, Pennsylvania, buddy.
Oh, my apologies.
Okay. I just wanted to get back to your favorite guy here. I know you love him. Hold on to your seat, Ronald Reagan.
Okay.
Okay. You know, I can remember very distinctly I worked with a guy at a cable company that I was on, I was going to say news company, that, you know, that's when that whole evangelical to the Republican Party seemed to really start. But my question to you is, did they ever do anything for the Republican Party? I mean, for the evangelicals.
Yes.
The Republican Party that's worth even talking about other than a bunch of rhetoric.
Yeah, there's they did something huge. First of all, the guy that volunteered or was recruited for the Reagan-Bush campaign to be their outreach guy to the evangelical community was the son of the vice president or the vice presidential candidate, George W. Bush. George W. Bush was the guy who brought the evangelicals into the campaign of Reagan and his dad, because his dad was very uncomfortable with the evangelicals. He was, you know, an old time Presbyterian, I believe, you know, New England. You know, you don't talk about your religion. And Ronald Reagan never even went to church. So, you know, neither one of them had any connection to the evangelical community. And so George W. Bush came in and he made that happen. And then what happened throughout the Reagan presidency, and I remember hoping in 1992 when Clinton became president that he would reverse this, because it also amped up under George Herbert Walker Bush as well. But during the Reagan presidency and the first Bush presidency, during those 12 years, there was a massive amount of money that got transferred from federal coffers to church organizations all across the country. George Herbert Walker Bush referred to this as a thousand points of light. Reagan referred to it as, using George W. Bush's phrase from 1980 or 81, of faith-based initiatives. And up until that point, the American people have been very skeptical about federal money being given to churches to do anything. And since that point, we are transferring hundreds of billions of dollars to churches every year in the United States, both in the form of tax breaks and in the form of actual aid, whether it's for education, whether it's for job training, whether it's for treating people with AIDS, whether it's for, you know, I mean, fill in the blanks, right? Whatever it may be. And this was, you know, James Madison's first veto when he became president in 18, whatever the year was, you know, after Thomas Jefferson, must have been 1809. His first veto was to veto a bill where Congress, instead of paying directly for the poorhouse here in Washington, D.C., would run that money through local churches. And he said, we can't do that. It would create it would establish a precedent of federal money being given to religious organizations that would be bad for religion. And Jefferson, of course, thought it would be bad for the country, too. They were both right. And so, yeah, the Republicans have gotten a lot, or excuse me, the evangelical right has been built by Republican politicians, and Republican politicians are being built by the evangelical right, right down to the, you know, passing out voter guides in church, which is clearly a violation of IRS rules. And yet, you know, in the last election, they were doing it proudly and saying, I dare you to arrest me or stop me or block me, you know, hoping that Obama or the IRS under Obama would make somebody into a martyr. But that's the story, Jeff. Thanks for the call. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What's up?
I may be too cynical, but I really do think, you know, by all accounts, Ted Cruz is a very intelligent man, you know, very smart, very accomplished. You know, I believe Yale undergrad, Harvard Law, isn't he?
Yeah.
Graduate of, they don't let dummies go through that.
You're right.
And I think it's a cynical ploy. I think, you know, he hitched his star to the Tea Party to get into politics and become Senator Cruz. And, you know, with that group, the more outrageous you get, the more votes you get.
So you think that when Ted Cruz repeats a lie that started on Fox News with some talking head, you know, just pulling something out of his...
He knows it's BS. He just, it gets the rabble stirred up and they vote for it.
Yeah. I hope that's the case, Chris. I would much rather have a Richard Nixon-style president who's just a liar, rather than
I
a deluded person like Ronald Reagan who actually believes what he's saying because his intellect is not, you know, broad enough to really encompass it all, or his experience, or he's not curious enough or whatever, which is not a total – I don't want to totally trash Ronald Reagan. There are parts of Reagan that I think were, you know, a decent person, but I really believe Reagan was –
Reagan was a tool.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he was. I think Reagan was delusional. I think Cheney was delusional, and I think Bush got dragged into that.
I truly think that Ted Cruz is cynical enough and power hungry enough that if he thought he could get away with it and it would win him the election, he'd be the most liberal of lefty Democrats you ever saw.
I don't know, Chris. Have you seen the video of when his father and a whole bunch of other church leaders anointed him back 5-10 years ago to become leader of the world?
That's what you got to do to play to that crowd, though. It plays well.
I guess. I'm just wondering what it would be like. I mean, his father is, you know, an evangelical preacher. I wonder who has been telling Ted since he was a child that he has a, you know, a destiny ordained by God to save the world or save America. And you wonder what that does to somebody's thought process. You know, I get it. Okay, you think he's just a cynical liar. I think he's delusional. We'll see. Or maybe we won't. I don't know. But in either case, it's not good. Chris, thanks for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And then there's the situation of Sam Brownback. You know, clearly his policies aren't working, and yet he's continuing them. Is he delusional, or is he also a shill? And welcome back. Let's see here. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. If you want to get the news on the weekend, you've got to have a satellite. Because with a satellite, you can get Al Jazeera, and then you can hear what they're saying about us.
Uh-huh.
Also, that will give you Link, which you know about. Amy's on there. And you can get Colors out of India, and you can get ABP out of India. And my Chinese friends watch stations out of China.
Wow.
So if you want to know what is actually going on in the world, you have to get rid of cable. Cable is for dummies. It will teach you that Ted Cruz is wonderful when you know as well as I do he's a sociopath. And Rand Paul's going to announce, and he's the one who said that all of us disabled people are fakers. And it doesn't do me any good to call his office and tell him to shut up and sit down.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I go out and I talk to people, I try to tell them about you and tell them about free speech, because here in Alabama, you're not carried on any cable station. You're not carried on any radio station. They've never heard of you. And so I go out and ask them, what do you think about the TPP? Is it true that, you know, it's some way to turn us into an international citizen and we'll no longer have illegal immigrants? You know, and they look at me like I'm nuts, that I'm some kind of crazy liberal. But if you don't know the other person's side, you know, it's like, you know your enemy. How can you even have an intelligent conversation about what's going on? When I ask people, how do you like the XL pipeline going across the fracking site in Oklahoma? It's like, what? You know, they have no idea what I'm talking about.
Right.
And I said, well, did you like the way it spilled in the Athabascan River in Canada and they can't clean it up? They've had over 600 spills and nobody knows. And I said, once the TPP is passed, TransCanada can sue us and put it through anyway. They act like I'm nuts. But if you want to know what's going on in the world, cable is for dummies. You've got to get a satellite so you can watch the other guy's opinion.
Okay. We had one of the satellite services for 5 years while we lived in Atlanta. Or, excuse me, in Portland.
Yeah. Well, if you want the news on the weekend, Tom, you got to get a satellite so you can watch the other stations.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Norma, for that. I'll have to check it out. I appreciate it. Billy in Wimberley, Texas. Hey, Billy, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hi, Tom. Listen, y'all are talking about Ted Cruz and how he's a sociopath today, right?
How he's a what?
You just, your lady just said that this guy, that Ted Cruz is a sociopath.
No, I don't think I ever used that word. I think I said he was delusional. I'm quite sure I said he was delusional.
Oh, you did.
There's
okay.
a big difference.
He's delusional. Your last caller said he was a sociopath.
Yeah, might be. But being a sociopath and being delusional are completely different things.
I recognize that. The point is that y'all are starting now on your attack of Ted Cruz, just like you started with Romney back in the last election. And Harry Reid is it
I'm telling you, Billy, Ted Cruz is lying to you.
From progressives.
I'm telling you, Billy, I'm telling you, Ted Cruz is lying to you. And this is the thing that's scary, is when Ted Cruz just comes out and says, oh, yeah, there's so many more thousand more IRS agents than there used to, and actually the number has gone down. Or when he says global warming, there's no global warming. Or, you know, I mean, when he just makes up stuff. The more guns there are in an area, the less the crime there is. None of these things are true. Now, the question is he saying these because they're politically useful? I mean, obviously, that's the case, but is he saying them in a politically cynical way? Or is he saying them because he believes them? If he believes them, when you believe something that's not true, that's called a delusion, and he's delusional. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Greg in Carpinteria, California. Am I saying it right, Greg?
Hello, Tom. I'm an ancient listener. I've been listening forever and hear nothing but how we're being defeated by huge money in government. It doesn't seem to be any way we can fight it. It's turning a lot of people away.
Oh, hang on just a second, Greg. You've got President Obama in the White House. There's the second largest caucus in Congress is the Progressive Caucus. There are progressive movements all across the United States. There's a lot of good stuff happening. And the Republicans have been very strategic and very smart, and they've got some very, very powerful billionaires behind them. That, too, may be coming to an end. It's not inconceivable that the president and Mary Jo White could issue executive orders that would mandate transparency in government contracts and publicly traded corporations. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff that has happened. There's a lot of good stuff that's on the edge of happening. I don't feel defeated.
Well, I understand that there are good people in government. There are good billionaires out there.
Sure.
But Jeb Bush they just found out that he's going to manipulate more money into his campaign by waiting until the final second and take PAC money all the way to then to collect another half billion or billion to run.
Right.
I mean,
I'm just saying that we
have been fighting for campaign finance reform and we haven't gotten it, but I have a solution for it, I think, and that is, programs like yours and social media out there can tell people, turn your backs on TV campaign ads. That's where the billionaires have you.
Right.
You control it. Nobody can be on TV unless they're backed by the billionaires. So why can't we pay attention to people who only run in our mailbox?
Well, it's a I'd say, Greg, that you can't, because most people actually watch television every day. And so, you know, it's like you can't hide from those ads. And those ads also run on radio, and they also have people going door to door.
You know who's funding them, Tom. You don't listen to them.
Of course. Well, you know, yeah, I don't. And you may not, Greg, but they're there. The power of advertising is real. There's a reason why it's one of the largest industries in the United States. Not political advertising, but just advertising in general, because it actually does work. It actually does sell product. You know, Geico got where they are by virtue of advertising, for example. So our job is not to say, hey, stop paying attention to those ads. Our job is to change the laws, to change the rules of the game of politics so that, like most developed democracies, money does not corrupt our politicians. And that is a problem we've got with our Supreme Court, which we'll be talking about in the next hour. Greg, I got to move along. Milo in Laurinburg, North Carolina. Hey, Milo, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? You're really starting to get to the crux of a lot of the genesis of these attitudes, where these people come from. And I think if you look with Ted Cruz, I mean, look no farther than his father. And if you look with Ronald Reagan and a lot of these people, you'll understand that they came out of the Great Depression era. And that was the era when big business went straight to a lot of the religious organizations and began to buy them up and control them.
Yeah.
And consequently, what you get is you get a person who believes, if they believe in a certain theological philosophy that is co-joined to a business or an economic philosophy, you have to believe the business philosophy as you depends on the theological philosophy. So you're going straight to hell if you don't buy the whole package.
Right. Yeah, no, you're right. And we talked last week about this process, the 1930s and through the 40s, of businesses getting involved with Christians, promoting them, you know, hiring Billy Graham basically as a front man. His son Franklin is continuing that work, Jerry Falwell and whatnot. Yeah, you're right. It was a way of expanding the base of the Republican Party. They realized that the rich people, the billionaires and the big corporations, they realized that if they were going to continue to hold political power through the Republican Party, they needed to expand the base of suckers, because there weren't enough suckers voting for Republicans. And it's why from the Great Depression until the middle of the Clinton presidency, with the exception of 2 years during the Harry Truman administration, the Republicans never once, outside of those 2 years in 46, 47, never once controlled the House of Representatives, and you know, which is the most representative of all the bodies. And it's because the American people were on to them. So, you know, they figured out, we've got to expand this thing. We've got to get more suckers into the fold. And they did it. Milo, thank you for the call. Jim in Chicago. Hey, Jim.
Hey.
Carburetors?
Yeah. You're a sciencey guy. You have that science segment. So, like, when we grew up, all cars had carburetors in them. And then in the 1970s, they went to fuel injection systems. Now, there's a story behind that. I'm still not sure why they took them out, but there's a company in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, the Fish Carburetor Company, that's now out of business, that made some carburetors for one of the big three, I think Chevy, and they found that it doubled the mileage. Hmm. And all 10,000 of them were rejected and destroyed down Fort Lauderdale.
Jim, it's a great topic for anything. Jim, it's a great topic for an Anything Goes Friday, but I'm not talking carburetors right now. Danette in Hinesville, Georgia. Hey, Danette, you wanted to talk about Sam Brownback?
Hey, Tom. Hey there.
Hi.
Wow, you've got a lot of people focused on Ted Cruz today, when what we need to be talking about is Brownback and how he is destroying Kansas and making people suffer to no fault of their own.
Right.
And I think it is unchristian. I think it's disgusting. And it's all because they don't know how to add, subtract, multiply, and divide. You cannot cut taxes and expect to raise revenue. That is the source of income for states, municipalities, and our country. And they've got, like you were talking about, raising and generating suckers to vote. They've got people believing that you can cut taxes and the quality of your roads will be maintained for 1,000 years. That's insane. It's crazy.
Right. Yeah.
And to expect poor people to be penalized when
they're
not
even the ones. Quick question, Danette. Do you think that Sam Brownback is deluded or that he's just a hustler?
You know, I don't know that much about him. I'm not sure. But when people like him make these claims and things,
right,
it angers me. Cause it,
yeah, I understand. Danette, we got to run. Thanks so much for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. On the line with us, Ian Millhiser, the editor of the Think Progress Justice blog over at the Center for American Progress, where he's a senior fellow with the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Thinkprogress.org is the website. And he's got a new book out. It's called Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Ian, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back. Thank you so much.
Great to have you with us. So tell us, just to begin, the Supreme Court's history of comforting the comfortable and afflicting the afflicted. I think a lot of people think that the Supreme Court actually saves us from crazy people, you know, or from bigots, you know, Brown versus Board of Education, or expands the rights of women, Roe v. Wade. Isn't the Supreme Court both a don't they have a history of being both a conservative and a progressive force in America?
You know, I certainly discuss the periods in my book where the Supreme Court has done the right thing, but one thing that I lay out is, first of all, those periods were extremely rare. So Brown v. Board of Education, on the day that the justices first convened to decide the Brown case, there were 3 votes to uphold segregation, and there were 2 justices who were on the fence. Of the justices who were present in the room, Justice Hugo Black wound up becoming a great proponent of civil rights, but you never would have guessed that from his resume because he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan before he became a justice. There are other people who were not in that room. Justice Jimmy Burns was the governor of South Carolina, who hired the best lawyer in the country, literally the best, most experienced Supreme Court litigator in the country to defend Brown, or rather to defend segregation. That former governor had been on the court. He left after a year. If he had stayed, he would have been an almost certain vote in the wrong direction on Brown. Of course, we all know that Earl Warren, Chief Justice Warren, wrote the decision. Warren wasn't in the room. Warren got onto the court because Chief Justice Vinson died of a heart attack while the Brown case was pending. And President Eisenhower, I have some other choice quotes in here from Eisenhower that I can't repeat on the radio, but Eisenhower later said that putting Warren on the court was the biggest damn fool mistake he ever made. That's the quote I actually can say on the radio. So you will see that, you know, through even though we had this period where the court was doing a fair amount of good, less good than you would think, and I can get into that in a second, it happened because of a series of accidents, which are unlikely to repeat themselves again. And if, you know, if you looked back on it, you know, you never would have guessed, for example, that the justice who was in the Klan would wound up being a big supporter of desegregation.
Right. Right. It's really quite remarkable. So the Supreme Court, starting in, if I can just kind of go step into the Wayback Machine for
sure
a second and get this kind of out of the way. In 1803, in the Marbury case, the Supreme Court asserted their ability to, or their right to, strike down legislation passed by Congress.
That's right.
And Thomas Jefferson, who was president at the time, went nuts. And let me just read to you maybe 6 or 8 sentences that he wrote to his friend Spencer Roane, who was Patrick Henry's father-in-law, mm-hmm. and the Chief Justice of the Virginia Supreme Court. He wrote, "If this opinion be sound, then indeed is our Constitution a fellow de se, legally a suicide. For intending to establish 3 departments, coordinate and independent, that they might check and balance one another, it has given, according to this opinion, to one of them alone, the right to prescribe rules for the government of the others, and to that one branch, too, which is unelected by an independent of the nation. The Constitution, on this hypothesis, is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they please." And then he goes on about how, you know, absolute power is absolute and not a good thing. And he said, a judiciary independent of a king or executive alone is a good thing, but independent of the will of the nation is a solecism, a blunder, at least in a Republican government. How did that transition happen? How did we get to a Supreme Court that has become so activist? And why, you know, I'm familiar with Andrew Jackson, you know, mm-hmm. pushing back and saying, yeah, good luck, you know, trying to enforce the Trail of Tears thing. And Abraham Lincoln, for example, in the Dred Scott case, saying essentially that really should only apply to Dred Scott, that, you know, the Supreme Court decisions need not be generalized. How did we get from a 3 coordinate branches of government to a Supreme Court that's running the show?
It's a good question. I mean, I don't necessarily have a problem with judicial review. You know, we have a written constitution, and I'm frequently very critical in the book of the times when the court has not followed our written constitution, when they allowed people to suppress dissent in World War I, when they repeatedly ignored the rights of African Americans that were written into the Constitution after the Civil War. So, you know, I do think that the court has an important job to do, but this court has wielded its power of judicial review terribly. You know, you mentioned that Marbury was the first decision to strike down a federal law. The second one was a little case called Dred Scott, right, which, of course, was a pro-slavery decision. We ratified three constitutional amendments to get rid of Dred Scott, and shortly after those amendments were ratified, there was a massacre in New Orleans. In Louisiana. There was a contested election. The African-American Republicans figured that they could capture the courthouse in a local parish, and they thought if they occupied the courthouse, then they would control the government. And a white supremacist mob led by a former Confederate general marched into town and massacred the freedmen who were occupying this this courthouse. The Supreme Court went on to say that African-Americans, freed slaves at that point in history, had to look to the states in order to vindicate their rights. So these freedmen had to look to their state government to protect them from these white supremacist mobs. And, of course, this was in the period when white supremacist mobs were becoming the governments of the southern states.
Right.
So, you know, the Supreme Court laid much of the groundwork for Jim Crow there. They finished that off with by upholding segregation. And then they spent 40 years doing things like striking down child labor laws, striking down minimum wage laws, striking down laws limiting, preventing workers from being overworked. During that period, they said that a woman could be sterilized against her will. And in the process, they ushered in an age of eugenics. And, you know, as I also discuss in Injustices, there are worrying signs that the current court is beginning to adopt the spirit of their predecessors.
Of the Lochner Court?
So certainly, I mean, the scariest case in my lifetime is pending before the court right now. This is this King v. Burwell case, which threatens to take health care away from millions of Americans. It's an attack on the Affordable Care Act. If it succeeds, an estimated 10,000 people will die every single year who otherwise would have lived. And the legal theory in this case would be a joke if there wasn't so much at stake. You know, I discuss in here what life was like for people in the United States before we had the Affordable Care Act. I discuss a woman who was raped, and she was told by the insurance companies that her rape was a pre-existing condition. She could not get health care. I discuss a family in there where the woman had a heart condition. Her husband was in a motorcycle accident, and they could afford to pay for her heart pills, or they could afford to treat his injuries. They could not afford to pay for both. Now, no human being should have to make that kind of decision, but certainly no American should have to make that kind of decision. The idea that in the wealthiest, most powerful nation that has ever existed, we are going to let people die from preventable medical causes because we just aren't generous enough to ensure that they get care, that is an abomination. And it is, I cannot imagine what would go through the justices' minds who are considering sending us back to that world in this King case.
So you're suggesting that basically King v. Burwell is a political case rather than a legal case?
I mean, there's certainly no legal basis for what the plaintiffs are arguing
right.
for.
Can you stick around for a bit?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's continue this conversation. We've got to take a quick bump out here. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. We're talking with Ian Millhiser. His new book, Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Ian writes, in fact, he's got a great piece up today over at thinkprogress.org. Ian, you still with us?
I still am.
Okay, great. In the New Republic, you write, never count on the Supreme Court to protect voting rights.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm guessing most people think that the Supreme Court probably played a friendlier, benign role, at least post-Reconstruction, in voting rights, uninformed as they may be. But, I mean, you know, what's the real story here?
Sure. So, I mean, the Supreme Court's history on voting rights has less been a story of bigotry at times than it's been a story of impotence. And what I mean by that is there were some very good decisions in the mid part of the 20th century trying to rein in Jim Crow excesses that prevented black people from voting. But the white supremacists were too nimble for the courts. the courts could strike down a poll tax and they just implement a literacy test. And the courts could strike down a literacy test and they just change the hours of the polling place. And the court would make them open up the polling place. And this was an actual tactic that white supremacists used. They would move the location of the place where people had to go to register, and they'd only tell the white people in town where it was. So what happened was, even though there was a period when the courts were trying to do the right thing on voting rights, they were unable to stop these tactics because courts can only enjoin something that that is already in effect. They can't say, okay, hypothetically, if you pass this law in the future, you can't do that either. What stopped Jim Crow voting practices was the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which said that in states that have a history of voter suppression, all new voting laws are halted immediately until a federal official has a chance to review them. And that's what welcomed everyone in the South into the franchise. The day before the Voting Rights Act was signed, 7% of African Americans were registered to vote in Mississippi. 2 years later, 60% of African Americans were registered to vote. And it wasn't the courts who did that. It was Congress, by making sure there was a way to stop voting laws without having, or voter suppression laws, without having to go through the courts. Of course, as you know, there's an epilogue to this story, and the epilogue is that just a few years ago, this Supreme Court, under Chief Justice Roberts, struck down that provision of the Voting Rights Act and killed the single most effective tool that the United States has in order to fight voter suppression laws.
Well, and the other epilogue would be, look at all the voter suppression efforts that are continuing in the South, in particular the you can't vote for the rest of your life if you're a felon laws, like in Florida. I believe just in the state of Florida, that's disenfranchised over 500,000 people.
That's right. I mean, as I said, the creativity of people who do not want certain people to vote has not ended. You know, you see voter ID laws, which the Supreme Court struck down despite the fact that they do nothing but prevent people from voting. You know, the argument, or rather the Supreme Court upheld despite the fact that they do nothing but prevent people from voting. The argument you sometimes hear for voter ID laws is that they're needed to stop voter fraud at the polls. Voter fraud at the polls doesn't exist. You know, there was a study of 3 million Wisconsin votes recently which found that only 7 of those votes were the product of illegal voting, and none of those 7 votes would have been stopped by a voter ID law. So the entire case for blocking people's fundamental rights is fallacious, and the Supreme Court said states can do it anyway.
Yeah, it's all just, it's Paul Weyrich stuff. I mean, this is, it's amazing stuff. Hang on just a second, Ian. We've got to bump back out here. We'll be right back. It's the Tom Hartman Program. We're talking with Ian Millhiser. His new book, Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Look at this. For the sane among us, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Ian Millhiser on the line with us, the editor at Think Progress Justice, thinkprogress.org, senior fellow of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, author of the new book, Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. So we were talking before, a little earlier, about the King v. Burwell case being essentially a political case rather than a legal case. I think you could probably make a strong argument for Bush v. Gore in that category as well, and maybe a few others. In fact, I'm sure there's a lot of others. What do we do about that?
It's a difficult question, and the reason why it's a difficult question is that if we had a constitution that was more amenable to amendments, then there's lots of things that we could do. You know, Alaska has a very interesting nonpartisan way of picking judges. In fact, they do such a good job of picking judges in a nonpartisan way that one of President Obama's appointees to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit was a Sarah Palin appointee to the Alaska Supreme Court. Wow. So there are models that work. That allow nonpartisan selection for judges. The problem is that to enforce them at the presidential level, you'd need a constitutional amendment, and the Constitution is very, very difficult to amend. Okay. Absent a constitutional amendment, the single most important leverage point that people have is the ballot box. You know, in this, when the next president is sworn in, there will be three justices who are over the age of 80, and one justice, Justice Breyer, will be coming up right behind them. He'll be 78 or 79. So the next president could appoint as many as four Supreme Court justices. If that president is inclined to take us back in the direction that you're hearing a lot of conservatives talk about, if he's inclined to move in the direction that, if you attend the meetings of the Federalist Society, which is a very influential conservative legal group, where they want to take the law, they want to build the bridge back to the 19th century. And there's already one justice on the court who wants to do that. Justice Clarence Thomas has said that he would take us back to the era when child labor laws were struck down. Under Thomas's vision of the Constitution, we couldn't even have the ban on whites-only lunch counters. So if we get four more of him, and there are very powerful elements in this country that want that to happen, we are in for a wild ride. What is at stake is the entirety of the 20th century.
Yeah, yeah. The Civil War era I find fascinating. This you know, the Dred Scott decision, arguing that people are property. We have a mirror image of that in Citizens United, arguing that property is people. And I'm wondering, in your scholarship, in your history, learning, reading, knowing, how far away from, you know, it's not my sense that civil war is about to break out in the United States, right, as a you know, shooting war kind of thing, but it is my sense that we are more divided certainly than I've ever seen in my lifetime, and you know, how does that fit in the historical context?
Yeah, no, it's certainly true that we are an extremely divided nation right now, but as it turns out, our Constitution has a mechanism in mind for how we resolve our differences, and it's called an election. You know, if we turned back the clock and Mitt Romney were president and he implemented the Ryan budget and, like, you know, all of a sudden Medicare was being phased out and people were losing their Medicaid benefits and all the other terrible things that Paul Ryan wanted to do, I wouldn't be happy with that. But, like, that's our own fault that if something like that happens, because, you know, that would be the product of the choice that the nation made. What you are seeing more and more with the conservative approach to the Supreme Court, and you saw it throughout history with cotton mills suing to get child labor laws struck down and the like, what you're seeing more and more is that there are groups who don't have much confidence in the electoral process. And if they can win the battles that they are fighting in the Supreme Court, then they don't have to worry about what the American people want. I mean, ultimately, that's what the Supreme Court does. If the Supreme Court had struck down Obamacare, they would be saying that this entire thing that, you know, should have been left up to the discretion of our elected officials is now off the table. And no matter who wins the election, we can't have it. And that should frighten everyone. You know, I mean, if someday in the future we have a court that is much more liberal than the one we have now, I hope, and I'm serious about this, I hope that they don't behave like a bunch of liberal Justice Alitos, because, you know, I think that democracy is very precious and that we should have a choice in how we are governed. And when anyone tries to take that away from the American people, it should be something that we find very frightening.
Yeah. Congress has the right under Article 3, Section 2 to regulate the Supreme Court. There are some tinkering around the edges regulations that a number of people have suggested over the years, allowing cameras, recording devices, making all their proceedings transparent and public, things like that. These are things Congress could do tomorrow to make the court at least a little more accountable/responsive. Thoughts?
I mean, I think that, you know, obviously I cover the court for a living. It would be nice if I could do that from my desk. So I support cameras in the courtroom. I think that, you know, we should be realistic about the fact that these are people who serve for life and, you know, they aren't really accountable to folks. So I think that there's a limit on what we can accomplish by shining a light on what the justices do. And, you know, I clerked on a federal court before. Most of the important work of a federal court, the oral arguments are often for show. Like, you know, the important work takes place in the judges' chambers. It takes place in letters that are exchanged back and forth amongst the judges or at the Supreme Court, the justices. And, you know, for good reasons, those deliberations are not public. So, you know, I think it would be nice to have cameras in the courtroom, but I think we should be realistic about the fact that the problem with this court cuts a whole lot more, it cuts deeper than sunlight is going
well,
to
but
shine.
If they were just subject to the judicial code of conduct, right now, Alito and Scalia and Thomas would be, you know, basically kicked off the bench for going to Koch brother events, wouldn't they?
I mean, I don't know if they'd be kicked off. I mean, the issue there
censured.
Is whether they're corrupt or whether they're ideologues. And I think ideologues are worse, because corrupt people, at least they stop doing a terrible thing when you cut off the spigot of money.
There you go. Ian Millhiser, it's a brilliant book. Thank you so much for dropping by, Ian.
Thank you.
It's great talking with you. The book is Injustices. Hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Ian Millhiser, Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. You can read all about it also over at thinkprogress.org. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ted Cruz, fascinating topic. He has officially announced he's running for president now this Sunday. Charles, in Opa-locka, Florida, you wanted to weigh in on Ted Cruz?
Yeah, first of all, I'd say I love your show, Tom. I listen to you every day.
Thank you, Charles.
Yes, I don't believe that we're looking at him right way. I don't think that, what was that that the reporter said he was?
Delusional. And my question is he delusional or is he, you know, a hustler? And I'm suspecting he's actually delusional.
No, absolutely not. I think what he is a big money type individual. I think he's a shyster. I think he's very calculating. With his background with the evangelicals, I think that's his niche. And, you know, if he was to actually, and to be honest with you, I look at him as a Ronald Reagan type figure. Mm-hmm. I look at him as I'm very scared of someone like a Ted Cruz, because if he does go into power with his beliefs, and to be honest with you, I think he would be like Ronald Reagan. I think he would just be limited. He would be a figurehead. And of course, to me, all Republicans have, you know, someone behind the strings. Mm-hmm. A la George Bush. And I just think he'd be a shill for business. I don't think American politics is what I guess you would call it, you know, back in the founding fathers wanted it to be.
Yeah.
For citizens. No, I think it's basically businessmen and business interests, because I remember just recently when Obama opened up relations with Cuba, and all the Republicans, starting off with Marco Rubio, was all against it. And Marco Rubio used this example. He said, he couldn't help every country that wanted to be, I can't say verbatim, but they wanted to democracy, because business interest comes first. Basically, he used Hong Kong, I think it was, where they had the riots. And he was saying that, sometimes when you listen, they actually tell the truth and they don't realize it, but he was saying that they wanted to back off as far as coverage, I think, and everything, and not focus so much on that, on what was going on, because business interests were suffering.
Right.
And they would suffer even more. So, you know, basically us trying to go into Iran, you know, us trying to put pressure, like the professor said on Thursday about Russia, you know, that was a calculated guess. I mean, that's a calculated move as well.
Yeah.
You know, basically, I think what they wanted to do, and they already did it, they got oil men, American oil people in Russia. You know, they just basically want to, whatever it takes to bring that economy down so they can get in.
Right.
And it just goes back.
To take it back, Charles, to the original question, is Ted Cruz a shill or deluded, a true believer? Is Rand Paul a shill or a true believer? Is Jeb Bush? I think there's you know, a shill or a true believer. And keeping in mind that some of these true believer types, like Jeb Bush, not to say that he is one, but here's an argument for his being a true believer as opposed to just a shill, would be that he was born into money. He was born a multimillionaire. He was born of multiple generations of multimillionaires. He has probably never stepped outside that bubble in any consequential way in his life. And or maybe he has. I don't know. But his worldview is such that he may well believe that what's best for General Motors is best for America. Only on this case, it's no longer GM. Now it's Walmart. What's best for Walmart is best for America. When in fact, you know, I think that you can demonstrably say that that's not true, but he may just actually believe that. And I think that we're going to have to go through this process with every one of these candidates. You know, are they shills or are they true believers? And if they're shills, why? And if they're true believers, what is it that they believe and where did it come from? And what does that mean for all of us? You know, I think that there's a lot of stuff here we've got to get to. Charles, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Sheila in Minneapolis. Hey, Sheila, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I think you're brilliant, the most brilliant commentator I've heard on the airwaves.
Thank you, Sheila. Not necessary to say. It really isn't, but I appreciate
comment. It's true in my book. I was just wondering, a Facebook friend and I, she brought up the point that she's been trying to find out information about Ted Cruz's mother and siblings, and so she got me interested, and we've been looking high and low over the internet. We can't find a word about his mother, whether she's alive or dead, or the murky past of his father with different women and alcoholism and the siblings. Where are they? And I'm wondering if you've heard anything about his family.
Yeah, interesting stuff. I read, and we did a fair amount of ranting about it here on this program maybe a year or two ago, a fairly long piece on Ted Cruz, and it was like in Rolling Stone or The Atlantic, you know, one of those long-form publications.
Right.
But the focus of it was how his father had raised him to be the savior of the world, the guy who
right.
is going to bring Jesus down, you know. Who's going to be here at the last days when Israel is surrounded and all the Jews get killed off, and except for 144,000 of them, and the Savior returns, and Ted Cruz is going to, you know, lead us to
so
that.
So what is mom and all this? Do they have her locked in a closet somewhere? I mean,
that's a good question. I don't have a clue. Maybe somebody who's listening knows something more about Ted Cruz, but now you've got my curiosity going, Sheila. I'm going to have check
good.
This out.
That was my point, because you probably have more research available to you than I do, and I promised my friend she's going to try Rachel Maddow, and we're just going to see if we can come up with whether this woman is alive or dead, because there was also the question of if she was actually a U.S. citizen
right.
when he was born, because I think that's how we got started on this. And
well, and here's the other thing.
Find her.
I mean, the whole natural born American, the whole natural born citizen thing. The way that, and in fact, the government issued a statement to this effect. The way that John McCain was a natural born citizen of the United States, even though he was born in Panama, was that he was born in a U.S. military facility in Panama. U.S. military
right.
facilities are considered U.S. soil. But Ted Cruz was born in Canada, and I don't believe his father, who was a Cuban refugee, was in the U.S. military. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure his dad was up there playing evangelist, and he was born in a regular hospital in Canada. So how can, you know, why is there not a birther movement around Ted? Oh, that's right. He doesn't have dark skin.
Right. Well, and that's what got us started on this, but because all we can find is about his mother is what he has himself released, and is there a way that he has somehow scrubbed the internet and he has his family, because we're
oh yeah
baffled.
You got enough money, you can
it.
Do a pretty good job of scrubbing the internet. Sheila,
all
thank
right.
you for the call. Let me see what I can find out, and I'm guessing that as time goes on and as Ted Cruz becomes more and more high profile, that there's going to be some reporters who will make him their beat if there aren't already. And some interesting things will come out of that. Sheila, thanks for provoking the question. I appreciate it. Tony in Decatur, Georgia. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I was thinking Ted Cruz is really playing this smart, if you think about it. He knows he doesn't have enough popularity to pull in enough votes for the actual nomination. But if he can come to the convention with that 10% of evangelical votes that he says is going to stay home, and give them to the eventual nominee, then he could be the kingmaker, have some influence at the convention.
Yep.
That's the game he's... And he knows that what he's saying is stupid, and the only people that's going to fall for it are evangelicals. He's not even trying to go after a moderate, a non-churchgoer, independent Democrat. He's not trying to go after anybody but the evangelical vote. There's a reason why. And that's why he said these people are going to stay home or we're going to excite them. The only person out there that's going for them right now is him. He's going to go to the convention. He's going to go down and sit down with whoever they're talking about the nominee is. He's going to say, look, I got 10% for you. Give me something.
Yeah.
Cabinet pulp. That's what he's playing.
Yeah. Well, there are some people on the periphery of the, I mean, we're not even in the periphery, right at the center. You've got, what's his name? The preacher who was on Fox News. Oh, yeah, Mike Huckabee. Thank you. You got him. You got Bobby Jindal yesterday talking about, a couple days ago, talking about how Christians are being persecuted around the United States and around the world. I haven't heard Chris Christie pontificating about Jesus recently, but, you know, I'm expecting it any day now. There's this cleaving to Christianity on the part of the Republican Party as if this, just like, you know, cleaving to war, cleaving to, quote, patriotism, as if that's what their party's about, when it's really not. It's just another strategy to bring in the suckers, is fascinating, but it's also troubling because, there's a lot of... I don't think that you can be a Christian and a Republican at the same time, because the things that the Republican Party stands for are not the things that Jesus stood for, in my personal opinion. And Tony, thank you for the call. And I would challenge any caller, any Republican out there, anybody who thinks that they understand both religion and the Republican electorate, to please explain to me how any of these Republicans are genuine Christians when they're advocating policies that would do the exact opposite of what Jesus told us we should be doing with our lives. I don't get it. I don't get it. And it's the outreach to the suckers. The Republican Party is made out of rich people, the shills for rich people, the spokesmen for them, and the suckers.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And I've known a lot of very, very devout Christians throughout my life, and devout members of other religions, too. And it's really a sad thing to watch them be played as suckers. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. 20 seconds. You talked about Ronald Reagan earlier. His vice president, George Herbert Walker Bush, who had an association with Dan Quayle's father, who ran Eli Lilly out of Indiana, and was basically the reason that Dan Quayle became vice president. How can a former vice president just disappear off the face of the earth? And when's the last time you've seen Dan Quayle? Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, good question, Michael. The last, the last I've heard of him is that his son is now a, what, state senator in Arizona, if I'm remembering correctly?
That I do not know.
Yeah, he's either a state senator, state representative, or he might even be representing Arizona in the U.S. House of Representatives. But Dan Quayle's son is out there, and he doesn't sound much brighter than his dad. I think the potato thing, where he didn't know how to spell potato, Dan Quayle just kind of became a national joke. He is, he was, it's been a year or two since I've, looked around or kind of Googled his name, but he was on the boards of a bunch of different companies. He was richly rewarded for having been a good Republican shill for 4 years and having done his job and kept his mouth shut. And his son has been richly rewarded too. The Republican Party, if nothing else, they certainly know how to take care of their own. They certainly know how to punish their own too. Thanks a lot for the call, Michael. Tom, watching Free Speech TV in Champaign, Illinois. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, I was watching a documentary yesterday on free speech, and it was called The Curious Case of Philip Marshall. And he was an author and a pilot, and he flew Barry Seals down to South America or Central America to pick up cocaine to bring back up to sell in America.
Oh, is this part of Iran-Contra, you mean? On behalf of the on behalf of the Reagan administration?
Yeah, they were hired by the CIA. Yeah. And they landed in this airport in Monrona, Arizona, which is a CIA base, I guess.
Right.
And, well, anyhow, Philip had written a couple books, One was the lakefront airport, I would think was the one in Morona, Arizona, and then The Big Bamboozle was the second book he wrote. And he was writing a third book, and somehow they say he committed suicide. He was right-handed, but he shot himself in the left side of the head, and they also shot his two kids and the family dog. And a bunch of the documentary went on to say that night a bunch of black SUVs pulled up to the house, went in, they took his computer and everything, and the third book he was writing had something to do, these people were saying, who knew him, said it had something to do with 9/11. And he had, I guess, got some information that people just didn't want him to have.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they, and so the police just said it was a suicide murder. You know, he murdered his own kids.
Right.
And the people who were in the documentary, they said he loved his kids. He would never do that.
Yeah. Yeah, Tom, I not having seen the documentary, not knowing who Philip Marshall is, I can't speak to it. It sounds like a fascinating story, though. Thanks for the call. We'll be back. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service up next with all the news. It's fit to speak. Stick around. Minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Who Are You Thankful For? To see an example, go to thanklist.com/watch and watch the story of Sholene and Kier, the slave from South Sudan. Victoria, welcome.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
So what's going on in the world today?
Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz today stressed at the White House briefing that the deal with Iran, which of course is an interim framework of a deal, the actual deal will be worked out in the next 3 months with a deadline of June the 30th, is in fact a 25-year deal, not a 10 to 15-year deal. He's the only person who I've heard say this. But I've heard him say it. I heard him say it on the Sunday shows yesterday, and I heard him say it again today.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's worth repeating.
Okay.
Keep saying it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Also, Yuval Steinitz, Israel's Minister of Intelligence and Strategic Affairs, today presented the U.S. with a list of desired modifications for the final agreement that he said would make it more reasonable. The Israeli government is saying that these changes are necessary to close what they say are dangerous loopholes. The list includes things like an end to all research and development activity on advanced centrifuges in Iran, the closing of the underground Fordow facility as an enrichment site. Even if enrichment activities are suspended there, Iranian compliance in revealing its past activities with possible military dimensions and a commitment to ship its stockpile of enriched uranium out of Iran. There are other specific lists.
If they were serious about presenting these concerns and objections, by doing so publicly, by dropping this basically as a press release, they're shoving in Iran's face that Israel is making these suggestions, which is not going to work real well. I mean, it's not going to encourage Iran to do it. If they were serious about wanting these changes, wouldn't the way to do it be for Netanyahu to call up President Obama and say, here's some of my suggestions. Just in background here, think about this stuff.
That would be a way to do it.
But that's not the way they've chosen to do it, which makes me wonder if there's a political agenda here, or if Shelley Adelson is funding this, or what. I don't know. I'm wandering into weird conspiracy theories.
I think there are many agendas at work here.
Right. Yeah.
I think there are many, many, many agendas on many fronts going on here. Part of it is putting things out there. Part of it is that they do want this. Part of it is that they want the world to know that they want this. Part of it is possibly an in-your-face thing. Part of it is that they know that these things are never going to be got, but they want the world to know that they said they wanted them.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So
that's a possibility.
Get it on the record, yeah. Okay.
On the record, exactly. But they surely knew that they wanted these things ahead of time. Could they not have said that before?
Sure. Sure. And also, we're not the only parties to this deal. I mean, you've got Russia, China, exactly. England, France, and Germany. I mean, it's the...
And the European Union.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
So, next...
Interesting legislation coming up. Representative Rosa DeLauro of Democrat of Connecticut. Gun owners would receive tax breaks for voluntarily turning in high-powered assault rifles under new legislation that she's proposed today. The Support Assault Firearm Elimination and Education of Our Safer Streets Act, expected to be introduced next week, will provide gun owners with an incentive to turn in their firearms to local police departments. Assault weapons are not about hunting or even self-defense, she said. There is no reason on earth other than to kill as many people as possible in as short a time as possible, that anyone needs a gun designed for a battlefield.
Right.
It would provide up to $2,000 in tax credits for gun owners who voluntarily hand over assault weapons to their local police department.
Wow. And how is it funded?
The bill in just after the Newtown shooting.
How is that going to be funded?
It's not clear in the information that I have how it would be funded.
Right. Huh. Interesting. It's a great concept. I mean, it's you know, the gun buyback programs, like the one in L.A., I mean, there have been a bunch of them around the country. They've generally been very successful.
They have been successful. I don't know how far it's going to get in this particular House of Representatives.
Yeah, of course. Of course. It's not going to go anywhere, I don't think. But it's great having that conversation. And this is the conversation Australia had back in, what was it, 89 or 93, or I forget the year, where that guy went on the berserker thing. And then
on a rampage, yeah.
Yeah, and then the country did a huge national gun buyback program. And it was wildly successful. There has not been a single mass shooting in Australia in the 15, 20 years since then.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah.
That's right. Accused Boston Marathon bomber Zilkar Sarnoff wanted to punish America when he killed 3 people and injured 264 with a pair of homemade bombs at the 2013 race, according to a federal prosecutor in closing arguments today. The defendant thought that his values were more important than the people around him. He wanted to awake the Mujahideen, the holy warriors. The prosecutor said he wanted to terrorize the country. He wanted to punish America for what it was doing to his people. Sarno is an ethnic Chechen who moved to the U.S. about a decade before the attack. He could be sentenced to death if the jury that heard 16 days of testimony against him finds him guilty. The
right.
defense will make its arguments later this afternoon.
But the United States has nothing to do with Chechnya. I mean, the Chechens typically, if they're killing people, they're killing Russians.
That's correct.
By his identity that he was, you know, he was trying to punish us because his people are being harmed. He's not talking about Chechens. He's talking about Muslims. Is that right?
Right. He's talking about Muslims.
So really what he's upset about are George Bush's wars in the Middle East?
Right. Well, he was talking about Muslims, and those are the kinds of things that he scrawled inside the boat when he was hiding out.
Right.
Yeah, it was Muslims.
So it takes us back to the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq and that whole disastrous era in our history. That's remarkable. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by thanklist.com/watch. Victoria, thank you for dropping by.
Thank you.
Great talking to you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Is it one of our questions for the day? Is it possible to be a Republican and a Christian? And in fact, you know, I would expand that. I'd say, is it possible to be a Republican and be Muslim? Is it possible to be a Republican and be Jewish? Is it possible to be a Republican and be a member of any of the major world's religions? that preach tolerance and love and compassion? Or is the only religion where you could be a Republican? I don't know. What is the religion? You know, maybe the 19th century version of Calvinism, you know, where the theory was that, you know, we're all born in sin and all that kind of stuff, Genesis, because of a woman. And that because we're all sinners, it's really tough. We've got to figure out who's going to lead us, who's going to guide us, who's going to be in charge of our economy and our government. And John Calvin didn't say it, but his followers did, that, well, the obvious way to figure out who are the truly good people among us is to see who God has blessed, which is the rich people. So we follow the rich people. Right, maybe 19th century or 18th century Calvinism could be a religion for Republicans, but and oddly enough, you know, the Calvinist Church is pretty much headquartered in the United States in Grand Rapids, or in that neighborhood, you know, where the DeVos family is, that basically owns the Republican machine in the state of Michigan. Garrison Keillor once reminisced, Republicans used to be moderate, business-minded civic boosters and unapologetic patriots who were the linchpins and bulwarks of small towns across the Midwest, the enthusiastic backers of projects for the civic good, usually in partnership with the town liberals, the librarian, the bar owner, a lawyer or two, the Methodist minister, the banker's wife. These Republicans were uniters and diehard optimists and persons of compassionate conscience, inveterate doers of good deeds. See, that's my dad's Republican Party. And Square Force One, writing over at Daily Kos, says, today's Republican Party doesn't appear to stand for anything but the things that Christ strenuously rejected, like organized violence, self-righteous division, and greed. So these people are hypocrites. They conveniently ignore most of what Christ actually said. Speaking of compassion, this is fascinating. You ever heard of the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee? This is a federal panel of nutritionists. It's a group of nutritionists who work for the federal government. They're not partisan. They're not Democrats or Republicans. They're bureaucrats. Bureaucrats isn't even the right word. They're experts. They're scientists. Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee. It was created back in 1983. Which was during the Reagan administration. And one of their jobs is to give the Department of Agriculture suggestions on how to tell America how we should eat, come up with food, you know, our dietary guidelines. They just came out and said, the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, essentially that being the best diet for the planet is being vegan. Now, vegans don't eat any animal products at all. Hardcore, serious vegans also don't wear animal products. They don't wear leather shoes or leather belts. I am not one of those kind of vegans. I actually am wearing leather shoes right now. And I realize there's a certain level of hypocrisy associated with that. I think all of us in every aspect of our lives have to figure out, you know, whether it's hypocrisy or whether it's just, hey, you know, I'm going to walk up to this line, but I'm not going to walk over it, or go this far and not go that far, whatever it may be. But the last time that I ate meat, with one single exception, the last time I ate meat was, as I recall, in 1968. I quit eating meat in 67 when I was 16 and became a vegetarian. And then about 4 years later, 4 or 5 years later, when Louise and I got married, I became a vegan and for a number of years, and then went back to being a vegetarian. And I was a vegetarian then for, I don't know, 35 years or more. And now over the last couple of years, last 2 years or so, I've been mostly vegan. I say mostly because if we go out to a restaurant and there's some cheese sprinkled on something, I don't get hysterical about it. I don't ask if there's a little bit of fish sauce in the pad thai. I mean, it doesn't freak me out. there is a moral piece to this, but I figure, hey, if 99.9% of everything I eat is like light on the planet, but it's really astonishing the impact that diet has on not just our health, but on our planet. There's British Meat.com, you know, one of the vegetarian societies over there, put together a really nice piece on the internet, 49 Reasons Why I'm a Vegetarian. And number one, conservation of fossil fuel. It takes 78 calories of fossil fuel to produce 1 calorie of beef. It takes 35 calories of fossil fuel for 1 calorie of pork, 22 calories of fossil fuel for 1 calorie of poultry. You know how many calories of fossil fuel it takes to make 1 calorie of soybeans? One calorie of fossil fuel. So if we eat low on the food chain, if we eat plants, we are causing the world to consume radically less oil, number one. Number two, water. It takes 3 to 15 times more water to produce animal protein than plant protein. Water conservation. Efficient use of grains. It takes 16 pounds of soybeans and grains to produce a pound of beef, 3 to 6 pounds of grains to produce a pound of turkey or a pound of egg. And if we just eat those ourselves, we're cool. Soil conservation. When grains and legumes are used more efficiently, they write over at BritishMeat.com, our precious topsoil is automatically made more efficient in its use. Saving our forests. One of the major reasons why they're cutting down the rainforests is to provide pasture land for beef. And by not doing that, I mean, you know, for a while there, it's been a few years since I've heard this, but there used to be this campaign about, you know, McDonald's in the rainforest. How that maybe they quit buying Argentinian or Brazilian beef. I'm not sure, but all of this. And then aesthetics, you know. Decaying animal parts, whether they're in your freezer, in your refrigerator, or on the plate in front of you in a restaurant. How is that anything other than gross? There are no nutritional deficiencies that you can experience from being vegetarian. There are entire societies that have been vegetarian for thousands of years. Vegetarianism is built into Buddhism and Hinduism, for example. Vegetarianism is built into some parts of Christianity. The Seventh-day Adventists are vegetarians. Look at the studies. You can easily research this stuff yourself. Seventh-day Adventist health. Seventh-day Adventists are vegetarians from birth, from before birth. And they are the healthiest people in the United States. No more agricultural chemicals. No more exposure to livestock drugs. There's over 20,000 different drugs, sterols, antibiotics, growth hormones, and veterinary drugs given to livestock animals. You really want that stuff? Worms and parasites, pathogenic microorganisms. Thousands of people a day in the United States get food poisoning from slaughterhouse stuff, getting, you know, around the kitchens and the restaurants, and it's invisible, the microbes, and they get on the knife or they get on the fork, and then they get moved over to something else that doesn't get cooked, and boom. You know, the next 3 days you're sitting on the john wondering what happened. About between 3,000 and 4,000 people in the United States every year die from this, and it can almost all be tracked back to meat. So you ready to become a vegetarian?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Or a vegan? Feel free to debate me on it. We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see. Sue, watching Free Speech TV in Green Bay, Wisconsin on DirecTV. Hey, Sue, thanks for calling. You wanted to get back to our conversation about the Supreme Court?
Yes, I'd like to, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Clarence Thomas, you had mentioned to him some time ago that he didn't step back and recuse himself when there was a judgment that would have impacted his wife and her business. I guess a couple questions I have is, why could he do that? How could he get away with that? And what can we do to stop them from actually sidestepping law like that?
Right.
Checks and balances there.
Yeah, not only that, for a number of years, he did not disclose the fact that his wife had made over $800,000 from the Heritage Foundation and aligned right-wing groups that she works for, continues to work for. Ginny Thomas. And here's the problem. There is this thing called the federal judicial standards, the standards for behavior that federal judges have to adhere to. And if they fail to hold to those standards, then they can be removed. They can be removed by their peers or by other mechanisms. And this fascinating piece of this is that all the federal judges have to comport with or have to comply with this. And if they make decisions that clearly have conflicts of interest, or if they do things that imply a conflict of interest, like Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia going to a Koch brothers retreat and presumably being at the very least reimbursed or even well paid for their attendance and whatever else they may do, or Scalia going duck hunting with Dick Cheney 3 weeks before he rules in Dick Cheney's favor from the Supreme Court, from the bench, Scalia should have recused himself. But the thing is that the Supreme Court has said that they themselves don't have to adhere to the federal code of judicial ethics for federal judges. That's for the little people. That's not for the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, we are the gods, right? We are the kings of America and queens of America. And I think this has become very toxic. Ian Millhiser, in his book Injustices, he talks about how basically the Supreme Court has been like this force for, well, he calls it a malign influence, malignant, right? An evil or destructive force in the course of in the history of the United States. The Supreme Court, in my opinion, is clearly out of control. They have gone way beyond the authority that the founders and framers intended them to have. Judicial review, yeah, maybe. Judicial supremacy, no. Yes, the Supreme Court should evaluate decisions in the context of the Constitution. It's the supreme law of the land. But that doesn't mean that they should have the power or even do have the power. I don't believe they do have the power to strike down laws passed by Congress and signed by the president. They have the power to say to an individual, in our opinion, you should not have been a victim of that law, and we're going to let you go. And every person who comes before us will let them go. But to say it for an entire group of people or class of people, I don't find that in the Constitution. Anyhow, 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Andy in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andy, you wanted to react or respond to my comment that I don't believe that you can be an actual Christian and an actual Republican at the same time.
Yeah. My goodness, Tom, I thought I was the only person in America that thought of that, that thought that. I've actually heard somebody else say it now.
I think we need to turn it into a bumper sticker.
Yeah, really. I come from a family, I never actually joined the Mennonite church myself, but I've got a lot of Mennonites in my family and I know a lot of Mennonites. Okay.
These are people who are serious about their Christianity.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I'm not as strict as I should be. As I said, I never actually joined the Mennonite church myself, but, I adhere to some of their beliefs. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the words of Jesus Christ himself, if someone were to smite you on a cheek, turn to him also the other cheek.
Right.
That doesn't mean you better buy an AK-47 in case somebody comes in your house with a pistol. You can get him better than he can get you.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and this was Jesus' instruction to Peter in the very end before the crucifixion, when the soldier came for Jesus and Peter cut his ear off with his sword, and Jesus says, "Oh, you know you don't."
Yeah, yeah. And there's another thing. There's a quote in the Bible where a young man came to Jesus. I don't know the exact words, but he was bragging about all this wealth he had, all these riches. And Jesus said to him, sell what you have and give it to the poor.
Right.
And the man
walked away sadly because he was very rich. Yeah.
Yeah, because he was very, very rich. I actually quit going to church because so many of today's pastors in these churches, super rich people are very often highly respected.
There's a whole theology around this, Andy, and they call it the prosperity gospel, where you've got churches now that are saying, come to church and learn how to get rich.
Yeah, but there are also pastors, I question their Christianity myself because they're advocating people buy guns for protection simply because a Republican, that's part of the Republican Party platform.
Oh, my.
You know, a true Christian... in my area of the country, down in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a guy came in and shot some girls in a school. Okay. He said it was because he'd molested them as a child and some excuse. I don't know exactly how it was. But, you know, most of the people, I think there's one, they were actually Amish, highly related to the Mennonite Church. Mm-hmm. Except for one person, I think, forgave that man, and he killed the children.
Right.
They didn't shoot back.
Right.
I wouldn't have the strength that those people had.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that today's pastors, they don't go by the gospel.
Well, I can't, I haven't done a survey of churches. I know the United Church of Christ, I think, is doing a great job. I think Unity is doing a great job. And frankly, this Pope, although there's still, there are a lot of retrograde opinions held by the Catholic Church, this Pope is doing some pretty amazing stuff. Andy, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Dave in Newport Richey, Florida. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Great. Republican Party, Christianity?
Exactly, yes. And I'm a lot like that last caller where I thought I was the only guy who had come to that same conclusion, too, because the entire plank of the Republican platform from, economics and trickle-down to, their take on guns and war – to suppressing the rights of others, to destroying the planet. It's the most holy and thoroughly unchristian platform imaginable.
Well, and in fact, when they claim Christianity, when they go out and pass a law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, it's intended to facilitate bigotry.
Absolutely, and that's why they talk themselves in circles when you hear Mike Pence talking about it. There's no good answer, and it's insulting. He must think we're so stupid, and it's insulting to even listen to him try. And it's just heartbreaking. I'm sure we all have friends who are Republican specifically because of their faith. They have devout faith, so they're Republicans mainly because of the abortion issue. And it's heartbreaking that they don't see everything else.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah, I agree. And that because of the abortion issue part, this is the perpetual conversation I have with a friend of mine up in Minnesota who's very active in the Democratic Party and very pro-life. And that is that there are parts of the country that are just totally anti-abortion. And there are, therefore, anti-abortion Democrats. And, that may be what it takes to get a Democrat elected. And just this whole idea of saying that either party has a complete monopoly on, frankly, anything is not a good idea.
But I think we need
to respect the people in the Democrats who disagree with us on issues like that.
Yeah, abortion is one unique issue because I think that is one, it's an intransigent issue and it's a legitimate issue. People can legitimately have, when does life begin? That's something that only each of us can answer for ourselves, right? So that at least is a legitimate debate. The rest of the Republican debates, they're not legit good faith debates. They're trying to scare you into voting for them by lying about the other side, and that's unchristian too.
Yeah, and who would Jesus hate?
On and on.
I mean, who would Jesus hate? Is he going to hate the gays? Is he going to hate the? Who would Jesus hate? It's totally bizarre. It's totally bizarre.
Yes, it is.
And as I said,
bringing it up though, Tom.
Yeah, and thank you very much for the call, Dave. Great to hear from you. And as I said, I don't think this is just Christianity. I mean, I the what little expertise about religion that I have is more has more depth in Christianity. I although I have studied some about Buddhism and Hinduism and Judaism and very little about Islam, and I need to learn a lot more and intend to. But my understanding of all of these religions is that none of them would be comfortable with the agenda of the modern-day Republican Party, which is trash the poor, right? It's a, take away the Social Security from the elderly. Cut the food stamps off from the hungry children. Really? This is your platform?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Oh, and while you're at it, of course, be sure to cut the taxes for rich people and give them more opportunities and more monopolies so they can get richer and richer and richer.
Really?
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you 28 minutes before the hour. Not a lot of nibbles about my whole rant about food. It's interesting, but a lot of folks want to talk about religion. Let's do it. Todd in Evansville, Wyoming. Hey, Todd, what's up?
I'm here. I was calling.
Okay.
About what you were saying about whether or not conservatives could be liberal or conservative or Republican.
No, whether Republicans could be Christian.
Right. You need to change that to, instead of saying conservative or Democrat, you should say liberal or conservative, because Republican or Democrat is a label. Conservative or liberal is a mindset, and there's nothing more liberal than looking at the people that just beat the hell out of you, nail you to a crucifix so you hang there and die, and you look down at them and say, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." There's nothing conservative about that. It was the conservatives that nailed him to that crucifix.
Yeah, because they were offended that he dared assert that he was the Son of God. I got it. Yeah, Todd, it's an interesting point. The reason why I'm saying Republicans rather than conservatives, although you make a pretty strong case, is that I still think that there is a role. I've always believed that there's a role, an honest broker role, basically, for conservatives and in our society and in our political dialogue. And that back when we used to have a relatively honest dialogue between conservatives and liberals, and I would say it was probably the first half of my lifetime, at least before the Reagan Revolution. Some good things came out of that. You know, conservatives are more cautious and more careful, and let's take this step by step. And you know, that's not always how change happens, but I would, maybe I'm living in a fantasy world here, Todd. I think of my dad, who called himself a conservative Republican. He would not know today's Republican Party. He would be totally astonished by them. And I'm sure horrified by them, but he thought that Dwight Eisenhower was a good guy, and a few other Republicans along the way. He was, you know, arguably kind of a Bob Dole conservative, and I don't think that Bob Dole was an angry, hateful guy. I mean, I disagree with his policies, but he wasn't like this current generation of Republicans. So anyhow, point made, and I understand. Thank you for the call, Todd. Great to hear from you, John in Minneapolis. Hey, John.
Yeah, I wanted to say that I think at least certain branches of Christianity are, you know, very abusive. I think they're abusive to themselves, to their congregations, psychologically, the kind of structure that they have, and how they, it's really about maintaining control. They're very much into power, and so they have long ago just dumped all the real content of Christianity in favor of being bolstered up by power, and they found an ally, and the ally was the Republican Party. I don't think the Democratic Party is particularly, you know, necessarily, you know, a reflection of religious values, but when I was told once by a Franciscan priest, you should vote your conscience as a Christian. And I could never, in good conscience, even though I might be against the two, you know, really bugaboos like abortion and gay marriage, I still could not vote for a party that does all the other things that they do. They're killing thousands of people. They are against regulation. They're against anything that has been built up that has serviced this country as good, in my opinion. And I think as far as Calvinism, you know, there's two branches of Christianity that out and out reject Calvinism, and they're the two large, well, the Catholic Church still considers it a heresy. They're not burning people at the stake or anything of this sort, fortunately.
Yeah.
And the Eastern Orthodox Church, and there may be even some branches of the Protestant Church that reject Calvinism. To say that a person, you know, that these people are blessed and that the poor are cursed is just to turn Christianity completely on its head.
Yeah, and for the record, that's not the position of the modern-day Calvinist Church. That was the position of the Calvinist Church 100 years ago.
They have backtracked from that, and they have changed their views on that. So, you know, and vegetarianism, it also, there's a traditional view of vegetarianism in both the Catholic and the Eastern Orthodox Church. You're supposed to fast from meat. You're not supposed to eat meat as much as we do in modern society.
Right.
So if you don't become a vegetarian, at least cut back to, you know, maybe two or three times a week, or just and use very little meat.
Yeah.
It does. I'm also very familiar with Seventh-day Adventists. I worked at Loma Linda at their university hospital, and I have a lot of respect for them, and I think they do great work. And I think that vegetarianism, if you can do it, is probably better. And most monastics in the Eastern Church, they never eat meat, and maybe on Easter they might have a little fish for a special treat.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I remember when I was growing up, public schools on Fridays served fish instead of meat because the Catholics wanted that. And the Catholics in the 60s and 70s were not allowed to eat meat on Fridays. It was, you know, that's what you gave up for.
And you know, Protestantism, they should read R.H. Taney's book. Oh, I think I was cut off.
No, you're still on. R.H. Taney is who? John? Oh, John was cut off. Okay. David in Littleton, North Carolina, says you want to talk about veganism. You don't agree with me?
I'm David Isles.
Hey, David. You're on the air.
Okay. Well, never done anything like this before. I found your show kind of by accident today. I've done that two or three times, and I love what you have to say, sir.
Thank you.
First thing I wanted to I wanted to get into politics a little bit, and then I wanted to get back to your rant about food, because that's very, very close and dear to my heart, food and saving the soil. When George Bush was elected, I read an article by a conservative writer that the tax cuts, he was so gleeful over the tax cuts that George Bush had just put in. And, of course, it was supposed to stimulate the economy, which you and I know it did not do.
Right.
But he said, he called it killing the beast. He said, we've got to break the government so we can get rid of these social programs.
That's an expression that came out of the Reagan administration. Starving the beast, actually, was the phrase. David Stockman invented that phrase.
That was the only place I'd ever heard it. But I thought someone like you needed to be aware that that was out there.
Yeah. Thank you, David. Thank you for thinking of me.
I want to also talk to you about the I think you need to expand your knowledge a little bit about this food deal, because the most efficient ecosystem ever in the history of the world probably was the buffaloes in the Midwest.
And they're vegetarians.
And I guarantee you, those millions and millions of buffalo didn't consume one single pound of fossil fuel. You were talking about how much fossil fuel it takes to raise beef.
Yeah, well, those buffalo also didn't consume a single ounce of animal food. I mean, the strongest animals on earth, the elephants, the buffalo, the bulls, they're all vegans.
Exactly. The most efficient way you can farm today is to avoid chemical fertilizers, to avoid all the chemicals, but to have animals on the farm. Manure says something really, really incredibly beneficial to the soil.
Yeah, you're right.
And raising grain, and those Midwest, out in the Midwest, there were over 4 feet of topsoil when that soil was broken out a little over 100 years ago. Today they have less than 20 inches left. It's flushed down the Mississippi River, and they've got an area in the Gulf that's so toxic nothing can even grow there. And every single I've got a rant about, because I've given lots of talks and had articles in magazines about soil conservation. Every single major civilization you can name over throughout history has failed because of soil erosion, depletion of the soil, raising grains, because that was the main thing that they ate, wheat, raising wheat, barley, rye, and making it into grain. And every one of those civilizations failed because they lost the ability to feed their people, including the Roman civilization.
Yeah.
And we're kind of doing the same thing here in America.
Yeah, the first one was Sumeria, actually, the Epic of Gilgamesh, 7,000-year-old story of it's now northern Iraq, but it used to be Uruk, you know, the oldest city in the Western world, I guess, that we know of, and they diverted the Euphrates for irrigation, and after a couple of generations, so much salt had built up in the soil because they weren't flushing the soil, they were just irrigating it. That the land turned to desert, which is why northern Iraq is desert now. It used to be very, very lush. And they interpreted that as a curse from the gods. But you're right. It was the destruction of the topsoil. And ruminants.
The Bible said the Israelites sat and wept by the waters of the and they were doing that because they had to clean those irrigation ditches out. The Israelite slaves had to clean those irrigation ditches out.
Yeah.
It was filled with silt. You know, all that silt would come down the river where they were raising crops and fill the ditches, and it's just a battle.
There you go. Yeah, and, the Rodale Institute is doing some great work on this over at rodale.org, and there's others on regenerative agriculture is the current in phrase, and it's actually more productive than fossil fuel-based or chemical-based agriculture, and it produces better food, and it saves a lot of soil, a lot of topsoil, a lot of moisture. David, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls, my thoughts, and the news of the day right after this. Welcome back. Scott in Canaan, Maine. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network.
Hey, Tom, let me get you off speaker.
Sure.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. Listen, I talked to you Friday, but I didn't get to finish up, but I turned you on just when you were talking to that woman in Washington there. Said something about giving up guns or gun rights or getting rid of them. I don't know. I only caught part of it.
Oh, you're talking about Victoria Jones. What she was reporting on how a member of the U.S. House of Representatives is preparing and hoping to introduce legislation that would give you or me or anybody else up to a $2,000 tax deduction if we took an assault rifle, a weapon of war, not a hunting rifle, not a pistol, not a target device, but a weapon of war. If we turned those into the local police department, we could take up to a $2,000 tax deduction. It's not going to go anywhere because the Republicans control the House, but it seems to me like a good idea.
Yeah, I know, Tom. I hear you talk about it all the time. Buddy, I used to be with you. Am I still there with you?
Yeah. You're still on the air.
Okay. Yeah, I got the TV on mute. That's why.
Yeah, that's good. Don't listen to your TV. It's a delay.
Yeah, but usually I keep it down low so I can at least hear you. I used to be with you, man. I try to be a good Democrat straight along, you know, right down the line. It's D, 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 D. And I tell you, I just can't get past the fact that giving up weapons is a good thing. I just can't do it. I'm looking at that book right behind you, and you're talking about 16. I honestly think it's going to happen this year. But
crash.
When it does happen, you know, it's better to have them and not use them than not have them and wish you did. Because there's some bad stuff coming when it does happen. Like crash.
Scott, a couple of things. One, if you're thinking that this country is going to devolve into, you know, Syria-like chaos where we're breaking into factions and killing each other based on economic or racial or geographic or other identity
All right.
You know,
just flat out food.
That would be a horrible. We had that happen once before. You know, in the 1860s, it was called the Civil War. We don't want to do that again. Number one. Number two, you have never heard me argue for basically the disarming of the United States. I'm not a person who hates guns. I'm a target shooter. I find it interesting and fun to play with guns. Okay, as I think most men do. But that doesn't mean that I think that we should have on our streets weapons of war, or that we should be selling to anybody who wants to buy them armor-piercing bullets. And by the way, most police agree with me. I mean, I just am the closest that I would come to gun control, Scott, is to go back to what Ronald Reagan proposed and passed in 1986, the Brady Bill, that basically said you can have all the hunting rifles you want, you can have all the shooting, you know, the target practice thing that you want, you can have all the self-protection guns you want, but if you want a weapon of war, if you want a silencer, if you want, you know, a 100-round clip, join the Army. And that's my position on it, and I don't think that that's Democratic or Republican. That used to be the official Republican line, Scott, and frankly, I think for some rational Republicans, it still is. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Alan in Chicago. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Hey, Tom, a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk a little bit. I've been an Episcopalian for about 8 years, and learning about my church, I learned for decades it was always known as the Republican Party at Pair. It was a very wealthy and educated church. The first Bush was an Episcopalian, but it's gone in a very different direction in the past few decades. Even so far as our presiding bishop, who is the first female presiding bishop in the Anglican Communion, and she's a scientist, she was published in The Guardian saying that climate change is immoral.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just curious as to if you had any insight on sort of where they went right, you know, because I have not been able to find where this shift happened.
I think it happened around gay rights, or around women's issues, one or the other. And yeah, you're right. I pay attention to what's happening with the Episcopalian Church. My mother, my parents were married in the Episcopalian Church. My mother was Episcopalian. And before I was born, afterwards, she became a Methodist. And I think that was just out of convenience. The church was just down the street, although they went to the United Methodist Church their whole lives. But the Episcopal Church was started, I mean, you know, it was originally the Church of England. It was started by King Henry. Correct me if I'm wrong on any of this history. King Henry VIII, when he said no to the Pope, you know, I am going to get a divorce. I'm going to kill this woman and marry another one. He started basically his own church. It became the Church of England. And one of the things that I always liked about the Episcopalian Church was it had a lot of the trappings of the Catholic Church, the kind of, you know, great music, good choirs, you know, nice costumes, stuff that actually for a lot of people makes them feel like they're in a place of worship. It makes them feel good, makes them feel part of the community. And I always thought that was kind of cool. But yeah, you're right. When I was young, it was the upper middle class church, and it may still be. I haven't been inside an Episcopalian church in probably two decades, but maybe three. But beyond that, more recently, I think coming out of England. I mean, you know, this is the Church of England. That decision to allow the ordination of women, which was what, 15 years ago? Thereabouts?
Yeah, it's been a while. Yeah.
I think that was the first big one, and now, you know, the discussion about whether they should sanction gay marriages or not. And I believe that the Episcopalian Church in the last year has taken the position that they will marry same-sex couples in their churches. Am I wrong on that? I'm frankly not an Episcopal expert.
Yeah, so I'm not an expert either. What I understand is that the church's official teaching is that you have to wait until a convention for it to be church-wide, and that's every number of years. But they allow same-sex blessings, but there are tons of dioceses that will marry.
Right. Oh, that's great. Oh, and there was also, you know, there was also one of the lead guys in the Episcopal Church in the UK back in, this was, you know, a decade and a half or so ago, came out as gay, and I think that was a big deal, if I'm remembering correctly.
The biggest deal, I think, was when an American bishop was openly gay and we ordained him to be bishop.
That's right. That's right. And that was that in Michigan?
No.
Or Connecticut?
It was in New England somewhere.
Yeah, Connecticut maybe. I remember. In fact, I want to say his name was Brown, but I could be wrong.
I don't think it was Brown. I can't.
Robinson?
Gene Robinson.
Gene Robinson, yeah. That's right. Yep.
Yeah. So I love the Episcopal Church. I mean, back in 2003, they were telling legislators that we needed a living wage, not a minimum wage, way before it was any political, you know,
right.
issue.
Right.
So,
I wonder how many folks who show up at the Episcopal Church are people who have left the Catholic Church, looking for a slightly more liberal church, but one that kind of feels the same.
I think a lot. And another thing is there's a lot of gay people that join the Episcopal Church that leave other Christian denominations.
Yeah.
Because they are fully accepted as, you know, God loves you.
Yeah.
Exactly how he made you.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, there you go. Very interesting stuff.
I just wanted to throw this out there real quick. I saw online someone wrote, if you're curious about these religious freedom laws, what Jesus would have said, he told you exactly in the Bible. If your government's trying to force you to do something that goes against what I teach you, and what Jesus said was, if a Roman soldier asked you to go a mile, go with him too.
Right.
So what they said, if someone asked you to bake them a cake for their gay wedding, bake them too.
There you go. There you go. Yep.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Alan. Very, very, very brilliant observation. Mary Jo in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You wanted to talk about Alan Savory and his theory of cattle grazing?
Well, yes. I know that you did a TED Talk with him. You did, didn't you?
No, not with him. He and I have both done TED Talks.
I thought you were on the same stage as
No. But
I'm a vegetarian too, and when I heard him, you know, he does sound very convincing until you start thinking about the fact that if there were all those cattle around, and I know that he's saying, you know, that wild animals would eat the cattle too, but there would be too many cattle.
Yeah.
And so people would have to eat the meat. In fact, he was encouraging people to eat the meat. So what did you think of that?
I thought it was fascinating. I thought, you know, the principal point that he was making is that hooved animals, and this would be particularly consequential for things like bison, buffalo, goats, sheep, whose hooves break up the soil. But they basically break up the soil in ways that allow it to aerate and get moisture into it and seeds and things like that, and that's a good thing. To take that the next step and say, therefore, we should turn America into pasture land, or that's going to save the world, I think, you know, I think Alan Savory overstated his case, and there are a number of studies and sites dedicated to at least semi-debunking that argument. Mary Jo, thank you for the call. Thanks to all of you for being with us these 3 hours today. We will be back tomorrow heaven only knows what the Republicans are going to give us overnight. But don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires all of us. Tag, you're it. Get over there to fantasticfungi.com and check it out. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.